You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 31, brought to you by Brill Cream. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the third trailer for the TNG Remastered project, George Takei's casting on Celebrity Apprentice, the new Bandai Next Phase Deck Builder expansion set, the casting of Benedict Cumberbatch as the villain in the next movie, and we'll preview the final two tracks from Five Year Missions Year 2. In the feature, we're joined by Michael Fisher as we discuss the Next Generation episode, The Bonding. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Hello, old chap.
And to whom am I speaking?
Well, this is Gregory Harbin, but, you know, I figured that since the cast of the new Star Trek film is all from merry old England, I ought to get in the spirit of things. So I'll be talking like this for the rest of the show. I hope our listeners are looking forward to that.
I'm sure they are, especially Colin, our listener from over on that side of the pond, as they say.
You know, I learned my British accent from watching Mary Poppins. So, which I hear is an authentic Cockney brogue.
Okay. Well, you know, I learned my British accent from watching Monty Python's Flying Circus. And, you know, as a result of watching way more Monty Python than anyone should when right. I was in high school, you know, most of my news in English these days is in British English, not American right. English. And so, unfortunately, when I listen to BBC News, all I'm thinking about is like the being eaten by a crocodile yes. competition or...
Well, I always expect them to just slip into a bit of some sort. You know, they'll be talking right. about unrest in Lydia, but then I expect to start hearing about, you know, someone's socks getting lost in the dryer. You know, some very drawl, doesn't make, you know, very subtle humor, but I never expect them to stay serious the whole time and it's very confusing.
Oh, exactly. It's one of those things that sticks with you. It certainly has with me. Oh, goodness. Well, Greg, you know, today is a... I think we're going to talk about The Next Generation today in the future, but I think that we chose the wrong episode because we really should be talking about coming of age, as today is a holiday here in Japan, and it is the coming of age day.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Actually, I've lost track of Japanese holidays. So which holiday is this?
This is when people turn 20 years old and they officially become adults.
Yes.
So right. you'll see plenty of girls dressed in kimono today, all done up for the celebration. But instead fantastic. Of that, I understand that we're going to be talking about the episode from season 8 in which Picard must broker peace between the lizard men and their delicious enemies, the cricket people, while Wes still sleeps in that rainbow turtleneck.
I saw that tweet. That was
Did you
fantastic.
See that?
Yes. That's exactly an episode, too. And my favorite part is that they're not just insect people. They're the delicious insect people.
Right. They're actually the cricket people. They're very specific.
Right, yes. The delicious cricket people.
Yeah, so everyone, that is a plot. If you're not following the Twitter account, TNG Season 8, at TNG_S8, you should go do that. They just tweet plots from the unaired 8th season of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yes, they do, and it's astonishing.
Love the things they come up with there. Okay, so Greg, again, you know, we do this show as audio, and the people cannot actually see us, unfortunately, but I can see you, and I see that you are wearing the official show attire for today.
Yes, I am. We were talking before the show, and I'm wearing my Ponfar three-way shirt.
All right.
As inspired by some conversations on Twitter.
That's right. Yeah, we were having a conversation yesterday about Deep Space Nine with a bunch of people. I know Trek Jen and Synthol and actually a bunch of people, Late Finds involved. And we came to the conclusion that I think the question was, is there anybody who likes Kai Winn?
Kai Wynn question.
I think the conclusion that was that no one likes Kai Wynn, and even the prophets do not like Kai Wynn, and therefore mm-hmm. she has to fake her orb visions, which led to the creation of what's going to be a very popular item, the Kai Wynn fake orbgasm t-shirts.
I think we all remember that scene from when Harry met Sally, when Kai Wynn's yes. in the restaurant and has an orb of the prophets.
That's what I was thinking of. I was picturing Kai Wynn being played by Meg Ryan.
Yes.
Sitting near the Bajoran temple in Quarks with an open orb.
Right.
Right. Well, why don't we go ahead and jump into some
tasteful
topics here, some Star Trek news. First thing up, Greg, I suppose you have seen the third preview trailer for TNG Remastered that has been released now.
Yes, I did. And I was very impressed. I think I messaged you right away saying you must see this if you haven't seen it yet. They released pretty much the ending of Encounter at Farpoint as sort of a split screen that it sort of goes back and forth to show different parts of it. But between the remastered Blu-ray edition and the basically old, boring SD DVDs. And it is really amazing what they've uncovered. You know, not just the colors in the reds in Picard's shirt, not just the colors in the purple tentacle aliens, but just everything all around is sharper, nicer, prettier, and just better to look at. I was really impressed by this trailer, and this is the sort of thing they should have done from the beginning. You know, don't just tell us about the 7.1 flute action. You know, tell us about, show us how much difference that this actually makes when they go through and clean it up.
Yeah, I wonder if they did not have very much footage prepared at the time that they did.
Yeah, that's definitely very possible.
First trailer. This one, it was unfortunate, I think, that they chose to release this as an exclusive video through entertainmentweekly.com, however, because it's not in HD. I mean, if you're going to show off the improvements in the series that's being remastered in HD, put the trailer in HD so we can see what it really looks like. You know, I had to expand it to full screen so that I could kind of see it. And then I had to go sit on the other side of the room so that the artifacts were not as noticeable. It was I'm hoping that CBS is going to post an actual HD version of this trailer onto YouTube. But of course, in a few weeks, we'll have the actual DVD in hand, Blu-ray in hand anyway. So
yeah, I figured that's their main thing. They figure if you're really interested to see the quality, you'll go ahead and shell out the $20 for the preview Blu-ray. And they figure it'll be fine if they just show for now. I mean, it is still, you can still tell the difference in the colors and the details in the background. Yeah, it's web video and it's still very much lacking. But I'm really looking forward to seeing the actual Blu-ray and seeing those details because, you know, even a rip from a Blu-ray, between that and an actual Blu-ray, the difference is really big. You know, just the act of compressing it really loses a lot of those details.
Yeah. Well, I was glad to see this trailer anyway. I felt like the sweeps were too fast. Like, I was kind of having trouble following what was going on. It was just a little bit too much. I think they showed the same scene too much. I would rather have seen sections of Encounter at Farpoint all the way through instead of just seeing Picard and Q and then the jellyfish Picard and Q and the jellyfish. But, like you said, this is probably what they should have done earlier on to get people a little bit more excited about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is going to just basically whetting our appetite bit by bit, getting us ready for that DVD. Then that DVD is going to get us ready for season one. Although it's going to be disappointing having to wait. You know, I don't mind seeing season one again, but it's season 4, 5, 6 that I really, really want to see in HD. And it's going to be really difficult to wait for those. It's sort of like with the 3D release of Star Wars Episode 1, January, February of this year. I really want to see, you know, 3, 4, 5, and 6 as far as Star Wars goes, especially in 3D. But I've got to wait 2 years through the middling ones to get to the ones that I really like to see. But nevertheless, really excited for this coming. What's the ship date on that Blu-ray?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I actually don't have that right on hand. Mm. I believe, because I have the Japanese one, I think it's like February.
Right.
I want to say 5th or something like that over here. It's a little bit earlier. Right. I think it's like January 30th or something like that in the States. Right. I have to go look up the exact date.
So I'll definitely,
the end of this month anyway.
Yeah, definitely. I'll have to run and grab it and make sure I watch it before the Ready Room that week. I'm trying to keep my expectations low, but based on this trailer, they've really made some big improvements.
Yeah, I did see some people complaining a little bit online about the episode selections, but someone pointed out that these three episodes provide great test material that, you know, Encounter at Farpoint is chosen because it has excessive optical effects. Sins of the Father has a lot of, it's very dark scenes, low lighting, and The Inner Light has very high contrast. So it's
and
a
the
good,
flute.
And it has the flute, because not only do you need to be able to remaster visually, but remastering the audio is equally important.
Yes. Very good.
All right. So I'm looking forward to that for sure. This trailer did whet my appetite more.
Yeah.
All right. Well, what else do we have up here, Greg?
Well, actually, we have some big news in the world of Star Trek celebrities in that the new season's cast list for Celebrity Apprentice has been announced. And among them is George Takei.
Oh my. Yeah, I saw this. This is the what I call the mythical Celebrity Apprentice show, because for me, I really liked The Apprentice, especially the first couple of seasons before it just became a series of advertisements for different companies. You know, like, let's design the new Ford campaign.
Right.
Yeah. Let's do a marketing campaign for Star Wars Episode 3. Let's manage a Wendy's.
Right.
But the first few seasons, I actually enjoyed quite a bit. But since I moved back over here, I have no way of seeing these things. And I always hear about The Celebrity Apprentice, and I've never, ever seen it. Have you actually had a chance to see The Celebrity Apprentice before? What is it like?
That's another show that I think premiered after I left for Japan, and I have not ever seen it. You know, I get the sense of it. You know, they get celebrities on. They give them business-based tasks to do and see how they do it. And it's mainly based on the fact they got celebrities that are entertaining in their own right that makes the show. I mean, the original Apprentice isn't around anymore because I think they sort of wore out the concept as far as getting regular people into that role. But with celebrities, you know, they're always going to do something. You know, you get Lou Ferrigno and Penn Jillette in a room together. Something amusing is going to happen.
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to go ahead and guarantee that the week in which the task is to rescue Captain Kirk from a cloaked bird of prey that can fire while cloaked, I think George Takei's team is going to win that week.
Nice. Very good. That will be the perfect test of strength. Now, the question is, when the task is to turn into a giant green Hulk, will George Takei be up to the task, or will that be... Will Michael Andretti actually be able to do that much better than?
I think the episode in which they roast Donald Trump and Lisa Lampanelli's team gets to spew gutter humor in the boardroom, I think that she's going to avoid getting sent home that week.
Now, I think we've moved through all of the celebrities that I've heard of on the list, all five
of
them.
Well, you know, Arsenio Hall.
Okay. Oh, yes, Arsenio Hall. Will he be bringing Marina Sirtis?
Yeah, they can have a special guest that week, Marina Sirtis, who will come in with her 80s hairstyle on to talk about the next generation.
That would be fantastic. I don't think there's a Get Marina Sirtis on Dancing with the Stars campaign, Celebrity Apprentice campaign, like there is for Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah.
But this would be a good way to just bring her in one week, you know, sort of, as we said, to whet the appetite for when she does eventually join Dancing with the Stars.
Yes. All right. Well, I was just looking over the list here, and I was, again, thinking this does almost look like it's going to be some kind of Comedy Central roast cast here. I don't know. It's quite interesting a crew that they've got here. I would be interested in seeing the show. I wish that NBC would put it on iTunes or something so I could get it, especially with George Takei on there. I would just like to see George Takei on.
Yeah, I mean, if it's on Hulu, I will definitely be watching. It looks like it premieres second week of February, so... I will be checking the Hulu and see if it's on there because, yeah, I mean, just his presence. As long as he's in it enough, there's a lot of people on the list. But if he's in it enough, it would be worth it to me to watch it.
Yeah, and just so people know, if you don't watch Celebrity Apprentice, what they are doing here is whoever wins this, they don't get a job as the president of one of Donald Trump's companies like they did in the original Apprentice. They get a prize of $250,000, which it then gets donated to a charity of their choosing. And George Takei's chosen charity is the Japanese American National Museum. So,
well, it's $250,000 to charity, and you get to be the star of the new live-action Star Trek series.
Oh,
so that's why. I mean, that's why Takei's here.
That's right. Finally, I'm going to get that Excelsior series. That's my really bad George Takei imitation.
You're getting there. Yeah.
Slow. I'm not as good as imitations as you are, but bit by bit.
Yes.
I'm just getting in there. All right. Well, why don't we move on to the next thing here, Greg? And this is the final week that we're going to be previewing tracks off of 5-Year Missions Year 2. We've now reached the end of the album.
Yeah, I told Mike he needs to go ahead and release Year 3 next week so that we have more to talk about. I don't know. The Ready Room is going to be strange without talking about 5-Year Mission.
Yeah, it is. We're going to have to find an extra news story to slot in here now.
Yeah.
Although, as the movie news keeps us picking up, I think we're going to have plenty to talk about. But I am going to miss talking about 5-Year Mission. Thankfully, I can still listen to the tracks outside of the show. Why don't we go ahead and play a clip from the next to last track here that we'll preview, and that's Amok Time.
An ancient drive of hidden sides and calls across the stars. I feel the change, I feel the flame.
Excuse me, Chris. I was just dancing there a little bit. I need to get back to the microphone. I love this song. It's very jumpy, dancey. It's another one of the sort of tell the story songs. I believe this was a Noah song. Is that right?
Yeah, this is a Noah song and has very interesting lyrics to it. It's in a way, it's a kind of a straight telling of the story, but not of the action so much, but as what's going on in Spock's mind as he tries to deal with Punfire, and you know, and then on the way there, it's in Year 1 they had the Spock song for the Naked Time with Vulcans Don't Cry,
right?
And then here we get to deal with Spock's biological drive, as you would say.
Very much so. Amok Time is another one of those great classic episodes, and I sort of expected a big fight song from 5-Year Mission, you know, similar to what we ended up with for Arena. You know, they could have even done another, you know, Sunday sort of thing for it.
It's Kirk versus Spock.
You know, we'll sell you the entire seat, but you'll only need the edge.
Watch the giant gong.
Exactly. But they didn't quite go in that direction. Yeah, I do like it. It's more, you know, what's going on in Spock's head during the episode. This is definitely one of my favorite ones just because it's so upbeat and poppy. I can always get back to a listener. That's part of why we had them actually play it live. If you go back, is it like, you know, 5 or 6 shows at this point? We had them on, and this is one of the ones they actually played live for us, you know, quote, in studio.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I'm glad they took this approach to it of telling Spock's story more as opposed to a play-by-play of the episode. And like you said, it is very upbeat song you go back and listen to over and over. Yeah. And well, now, Greg, we're going to have to get to the final track from Year 2, which is Who Mourns for Adonais.
Which I believe this is your, at least you were saying this was your favorite song off of the album.
Yeah, it is one of my favorites. It's the combined, you know, there's a little extra to this song that makes it my favorite. But let's play a clip.
Giant hand in the sky could cry. Surprise. He addresses the crew pretentiously. As mankind progressed, forgotten those things which gave life meaning. There's an order to things in the universe, and your time has passed. The God Apollo appears.
Now, Adonais is one of those songs I was talking about when we were first previewing the album for people before most people had heard it. And I was talking about how this was a much more complex album, that I felt like they were going places with complex melodies and harmonies. This song is really a lot of what I'm talking about there, where it's a lot of instruments in the background, it's a lot of different harmonies and counter-harmonies going on. Just musically, it's a really great song to listen to.
Yeah, it is. And it has, you know, two flavors to it, because it starts out slowly. Mm-hmm. And then it picks up towards the end. And I particularly love the lyrics on this one. It sums up a lot of... yesterday I was recording a Matterstream show with Kevin C. Neese, who talks with the Undiscovered Country Project, and we were talking about religion in Star Trek and how these things are portrayed in Star Trek, you know. And this episode is a great example of that, because the idea that these aliens came to Earth, you know, 5,000 years ago, and the Greeks mistook them for gods. And,
right.
And, you know, that's how... you know, religion's often portrayed in Star Trek in this kind of
right.
humanistic future. But the lyrics here that Patrick wrote for this song really capture the essence of this episode so well. And that's maybe another reason why this is one of my very favorite tracks on the album. Yeah.
It's a great one to end it. You know, it reminds me a lot of the ending song off of the Weezer's Blue album, Only in Dreams, which... again, starts very slowly and has this just long intro into this really emotional song. It's just a great way to sum it up. And it's great that that's the song that ends year two. You know, it didn't just fall in the middle. It does finish the album really well. I can't wait to jump into year three with an exciting song. But this one is a really great one. It makes me feel, yes, I've had a whole meal. I've had a whole Star Trek experience once I come to this one.
And keep in mind that this all sprung from an episode in which a giant green hand grabs the Enterprise.
Speaking of Monty Python.
That's right. All right. So that's it for 5-Year Mission Year 2, as far as our reviews and previews go. So you can pick up the album at Amazon. I did check. It is at the Amazon MP3 store. And we'll have links to both of those in the show notes if you want to click through to your choice of store, or you can go over to 5yearmission.net and order it directly from the guys.
Fantastic. And now we just have to wait for the Trouble with Tribbles EP, and we can start previewing that as well.
Right. And we can hear Andy sing for the first time.
Excitement.
We're waiting on that, Andy. All right. Well, moving on, Greg, how are your... game night's going? Are you still playing the Bandai deck building game?
I'd love to be. I haven't actually made it back into Seattle for one of the game nights yet. I was going to go this week, but then I had company earlier today. It's much more difficult to make it into Seattle when you're not living in Seattle. I need to make that a priority, though, because I haven't actually played the Star Trek deck building game in about a month and a half. And I either need to just start inviting people over and do it here, or force other people to play it with me. But this next news story actually kind of came as a surprise for me. I didn't realize that this was coming, especially not so soon. But it's an expansion pack for the deck building game.
Yeah, it's something that I guess they have in the past released after certainly the time goes by. I mean, the deck building game came out, what, last summer? Was it August?
I believe it was right when I got here, so yeah. August, September, so that time frame.
Yeah, the one you've been playing. And so this one, it's called The Next Phase. It gives you new missions. There's the Borg Invasion 2. I understand, now I haven't played the first card game because I didn't have anyone to play with, but I understand there's a Borg Invasion scenario in there.
Right. Yeah, and the final boss in the Borg Invasion scenario is actually Locutus.
Okay.
You have to defeat him, and then you win it. And basically, either Locutus wins and the players lose, or the players win and Locutus loses. So in this new expansion pack, they figured you defeat Locutus. Now it's time to go up against the Queen.
Oh, okay. All right.
So they have a new Borg Queen card. They have new Borg cards and a whole new scenario. They're going to make the Borg a little bit tougher to deal with for more experienced players.
I see. Well, that explains some, because I was reading it and they were saying that if you have become an experienced captain and the leader of the Klingon Empire, yeah, and you've defeated Locutus,
right,
then you move on to the next phase edition.
They don't mean that literally, Chris. Locutus really? Has not come to your house and you defeated him in hand-to-hand combat.
Really? So why did Martok show up at my house? Why did I have to defeat Gowrine?
Oh, wow.
I mean, you should see, that's we're rough. Still trying to clean up the walls from all the blood wine that's splattered everywhere around here.
Oh, man.
I got to stop taking these things so literally.
You got to stop taking something, that's for sure, yeah. Chris.
And not only that, but I've also got to find out who those guys were that were dressed up as Klingons coming to my house.
Oh, man. But it does look in general like this is just extra cards for the main game. It's actually 300 cards, which I'm trying to remember how many cards were the original pack, but it was only about 450 or 500. So this is a big addition to the deck you already have. And I think it's going to really open up just the more different things that can happen. You know, I haven't received word on whether there's a Pulaski card, but I would be actually pretty surprised if they haven't moved into that sort of that tier of people. There's a lot of people from later seasons and even some people like Pulaski that just didn't make it into the first set.
Oh, I'm sure there's a Pulaski card. I think that you can power up when you play the Pulaski card and the Kyle Riker card together.
Oh, nice. No, I thought Pulaski's special ability was to make all other Beverly Crusher cards take a year at Starfleet Medical.
That's right. Yeah, as soon as your opponent whips out that Beverly Crusher card, it's kind of like Uno. Yeah, it's like Uno when someone thinks they've got you and you slap down yes. a draw four on them. Yeah,
exactly.
All right. So I assume you'll be picking this set up at some point when it comes out.
It definitely will be. Out. Now that I know that it's out, as of, I believe, January 6th, it came out. So
yeah, it came out. Last Friday.
Now that I know it's out, I need to head back downtown to Gamma Ray Games and pick it up. I got the Penny Arcade game, and I haven't found anyone to play that with. So I really need to get back in my game nights. Seattle Trek FM readers, listeners, please give me a buzz. I know ClayStation and Sci-Fi Core I've been needing to hang out with at some point. So guys, let me know, you know, when you're available, because I really love board games so much, and I just can't find anyone to play with. I think I'm going to need Counselor Troy.
Seems that way. Yeah, I'll have to, I'll only get to play if someone invents a great way to play these card games by web camera.
I could probably do that. You know, I need to look at it, but I can put the cards up to the camera for you. I have this new HD camera. You know, it's 1080p. I'll just hold them up and you can read them. I think it'll work.
Yeah, I think it's possible to do it, but I think that the overhead and setting up and moving two people's cards on both sides of the camera might be a little bit much.
Possibly.
Yeah. All right. Well, it looks like it's going to be a fun set, though.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to picking that up.
An ancestor of mine maintained that if you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
Actually, Chris, now that that little clip you put together has become quite prescient, as the ancestor that Spock's referring to is, of course, either Arthur Conan Doyle or Sherlock, which is related to our next news item.
That's right. That's right. Now, apparently, J.J. Abrams is attempting to assemble an all-British acting team for the next Star Trek movie.
Indeed.
And we found out about quite a few actors who have been cast over the past few weeks, including we finally now have a villain who comes in the form of British actor Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah, you know, my theory is that J.J. Abrams fell asleep one night with the BBC America on, and it just invaded his dreams, and he had basically a waking dream, a lucid dream, in which all of these different people from all these different shows all showed up in his own Star Trek film. And then he just had to make it happen.
It seems that way. There's something going on for sure. This casting was quite interesting to me because after the Benicio del Toro bit and then everyone who was looked at after that and all the actors of Latin descent who were being looked at, everyone was so up in arms about the possibility that it was Khan.
Yeah.
And now with Cumberbatch being cast as the villain, I really don't think that this is going to be Khan anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really surprised that J.J. Abrams would have Sherlock Holmes show up as the villain, but I think it's going to work. You know, it'll be a holodeck film. We haven't actually had a holodeck Star Trek film yet. I'm assuming Data's going to be there as well. It's going to be a weird sort of crossover thing. Now, the question is Martin Freeman going to be there as Watson as well?
It is going to be weird, but you know, the fans were saying that some fans have said that they would like to see movies with crews from different series mixed together, and you know, what better way to do it than an alternate timeline?
I don't know if we've said yet who this guy is. Benedict Cumberbatch, he is Sherlock Holmes in the BBC Sherlock show, which also stars, I believe I'm getting his name right, Martin Freeman as Watson. Freeman will be seen in The Hobbit coming up as Bilbo. He was also in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but that's not as important today as the fact that Benedict Cumberbatch is also in The Hobbit. He's Smaug the Dragon, as well as having some other role. But his main role that people know him from is on stage in England and also as Sherlock, which strangely, just before this was announced, which I don't know why this happened, but I actually watched an episode of the series right before it was announced. And so I was reading and I was like, I know who that guy is. Okay. Were you familiar with Benedict before the announcement?
No, I was not. And I haven't seen the BBC Sherlock series, although now with this casting, I'm going to go see if I can find it somewhere.
I think there's a whole series of it, although knowing England, that probably means about 4 episodes.
Yeah, I think they're like 7 episodes.
Seriously. It's not like American TV.
Right. Yeah, that's how the British series go. But yeah. I am interested to see him in there. And, you know, I really don't have any thoughts on whether the casting is good or bad as far as villain goes, since I'm not familiar with his work. But I am wondering who he's going to be. And I hadn't really considered this until just now, but obviously he's going to be Smaug the Dragon.
That's perfect.
You know, because if you remember on one of the very early Ready Rooms, we talked about what a coup it would be if they could somehow combine The Hobbit and the next Star Trek movie. You remember we talked about this,
I do,
right?
Actually, this is
well,
a thing.
Look what's happening. I mean, you know, people talk about how, oh, Nostradamus knows what's going to happen in the future. I mean, look at us. We had this pegged 8-9 months ago.
So I'm thinking at the beginning of the film, the Smaug the Dragon probe shows up and is wondering where Smaug the Dragon is.
Where are all the dragons? Last time we were on Earth, there were dragons everywhere. They were fighting knights and they were kidnapping damsels, and the damsels in distress had to be rescued by the knights, and now there are
Bernadette
no dragons.
In the countryside, yeah.
And so now the probe comes in, and I assume that the dragon probe actually breathes fire down onto the Earth from that hole. And then what happens? So now Chris Pine, and his crew are going to slingshot around the sun, right?
Yep.
Go back in time to medieval times.
Well, not medieval times, but actually to Middle Earth.
Oh, yeah, they've got to go.
I mean, just imagine the scene. They show up in Hobbiton on the HMS Bounty, and they're invisible, but then they show up at the Hobbit Hole. Gandalf's there. They're all crowded around the fireplace trying to explain to him, we must go after Smaug the Dragon and bring him back to 23rd century Earth.
And then in a surprising cameo appearance at the Hobbit Hole, Guinan is serving drinks back there.
That actually makes perfect sense. She is rather old, I believe.
That's true. Now, to get to Middle Earth, as opposed to just, say, San Francisco, Are there some additional calculations that Spock is going to have to do from memory as they slingshot around the sun?
Most likely, but I think it's just a few more rounds around the sun. You know, just go around once, go around twice, and you're basically there.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. The thing is, you don't want to show up too late. You want Bilbo for this one. Frodo, he's a little whiny. Show up early enough that Bilbo can help out.
I just hope that Bilbo's not a drunk that listens to a broken jukebox.
Oh, that's perfect.
All right. All right. Well, getting back to some actual possible connections to the movie. There have been three polls going on about this. We've been doing our own poll. Trek Movie's been doing a poll. TrekNews.net's been doing a poll.
Yeah.
Of asking people, who do you think that Cumberbatch is going to play in the movie? Now,
yeah.
I'll start. Let me tell you some of the results, and we'll talk about a few of these. Our own poll, our options were an all-new villain, which got 47% of the vote so far. Gary Mitchell got 9% of the vote. Sherlock Holmes actually got 9% of the vote. So I think some people are hoping for a multi-generational story here involving the holodeck. Yeah. Trelane got 9%. Khan got 6%. The Tribble King did get 6% of the vote, mm-hmm. which listeners will remember our theory from last Ready Room about the Tribble yep. King. And Kor or Koloth got 3%. Lazarus got 3%. And a couple of other, the rest of it goes to others, which have included Harry Mudd and Bele or Lokai from Let That Be Your Last Battlefield.
Right. The initial rumor when he was announced was that he was going to be Gary Mitchell, which obviously doesn't really make sense considering they've already done Mitchell in the comic book. There's no reason. I mean, doing him first was basically Orky saying, we're not going to be doing Mitchell. So we can move on from there. Ain't It Cool News posited that it could be Harry Mudd, which is possible. Highly unlikely.
You know, they've gone to such lengths to me. I know they're looking for good actors as well, but also as they've casted the first movie and so far who I think some of these people may be playing, they've really tried to find actors who do resemble the original characters. And I just cannot see him being Harry Mudd.
Right.
That one doesn't make it. And I agree with you that it's not Gary Mitchell. They would not have killed Gary Mitchell again in the comic series if they were going to have him in the movie.
Yeah. The thing I think is most likely, actually, is that he'll be playing a Klingon. That's either a Klingon or a Vulcan of some sort. But yeah, I'm really going with, I don't know if it'll be Kor or Koloth. Those are definitely possibilities, you know. But, you know, going on with the, you know, he's a stage actor. They love getting stage actors for playing Klingons as well. So we'll see. I don't know if he'd be up for, you know, donning the wig and the facial makeup and all of that. Mm-hmm. Be interested to see what they do. I mean, we haven't really seen Klingons yet in the JJ verse. I believe there's a deleted scene that might show them.
Well, there's a deleted scene, but you don't see them. They're wearing some kind of helmets, but the helmets have forehead ridges, like the Next Generation Klingons.
Yeah.
So I don't know. My thoughts here, now I've been saying for weeks now that I think the villain is going to be Kor or Koloth.
Right.
And so that would make sense. And I could see him. I saw someone has been photoshopping, I think Trek Movies article has a bunch of images where people have photoshopped Cumberbatch's face onto characters, you know, from the original series. And the Klingon that they did looks ridiculous. However, that doesn't mean that they could not make him a good Klingon in the actual movie.
Right.
It's just someone who doesn't know how to use Photoshop very well quickly doing that. It looks that way. But that's who I think he will play. My other thought is that it could be Trelane, but I think that if you were going, like you just said, they like to get stage actors to do these Klingon roles. You remember like Christopher Plummer, it was so wonderful in Star Trek VI.
Really good.
Whereas if they were going to do Trelane, I think they would probably get someone with more of a comedic slant to their background to play Trelane.
Right. That's what it feels like. I haven't watched much of Sherlock. He doesn't strike me as a very comedic person. he does strike me that he could do a very good villain, you know. So
yeah,
it would be going against type for him at this point, given that he plays such a heroic figure. But I do think that's a great direction, especially, you know, thinking back to Plummer doing a Klingon as well. So
yeah. So the other poll results, because the other two polls differ from ours quite a bit. So Trek movies options were a new alien villain and a new human villain. And they got 28% for an alien villain, 24% for a human villain. They also asked a Klingon, which got 11%. They asked Q, 11%. Interestingly, they asked Q, but not Trelane, given
that's odd.
The original series timeline. Khan got 6% in their poll as well, same as ours. Gary Seven, 5%, although Gary Seven was not a villain.
Not really, no.
I mean, he was, in fact, the whole point of Assignment Earth was to do a spinoff series where he was trying to protect the Earth from you know, aliens. So I don't see that one. The Garth of Izar, 4%, or an other known Star Trek character erased, 10%.
Interesting.
Any thoughts on any of those?
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to do Q in the next film.
No.
And I don't see Cumberbatch playing Khan. That would just be rather ridiculous. I'm starting to think that the whole Benicio del Toro thing may have just been a red herring or just false in general. Although, I mean, I don't know. This is going to be a thing we're going to have to find out after the fact. You know, at this point, it's really difficult to speculate on what it's going to be. It definitely looks like, from all the polls I've seen, people want to see a new villain in general.
Yeah.
You know,
that's what, yeah, everyone seems, about half of everyone wants to see a new villain.
Yeah. I don't know that I want to see a human villain. I do definitely want to see an alien villain of some sort. I don't need this guy to be, you know, from the Starfleet, you know, London branch, and he's here to shake things up. That's, I'm not really excited for that.
I think the only human villain that you might go with would be Khan, and I'm quite sure with this casting that it's not Khan. Now, the whole thing with Benicio del Toro and the other actors who were considered, I think all of them could have played Klingons, and
that also makes
me think again that maybe it was Klingon all along.
Yeah.
Just real quickly here, Trek News Net's poll, they just asked about races. 32% voted for an Andorian, 19% a Vulcan, 19% a Klingon, 12% a human, and 9% a Romulan.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't necessarily want to see them jump back into Klingons, given how many of the original series films were Klingons. But if you think about it, it's been, 12 years? No, even more than that, 20 years since we've actually seen a Klingon-based Star Trek film. So, let's jump back into it. I mean, Andorians, I'd love it if Andorians showed up. I don't know if it needs to be an Andorian villain, though. We'll see. I mean, definitely there would have been Andorians in the Enterprise film that they never made.
That's right. All right. Well, we'll find out where this is going. I'm sure that a lot of news will come out over the next few weeks. So we'll talk plenty more about Cumberbatch. Last two quick ones here in terms of casting. We have Noel Clarke, who is on Doctor Who, has been cast. We really don't know who he's going to play, other than the word is that he will be playing a family man with a wife and young doctor.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what any of that means at the moment.
I don't know. It could apply to just about any scenario. I'm pretty sure it's not going to be Homer Simpson, even though Homer is married and does have a young daughter, in fact, two of them.
Right.
The fact that they did not mention a son that likes for people to eat his shorts, that's not going to be him.
Right.
But anyway, that was reported by Variety, I believe, and not much else. But to go along with Clark's character, they have cast an actress who is known for portraying Kayla Hassan on 24, and that's Nazneen Contractor.
That's right.
Which is a great name.
Yeah, I mean, she was with Nana Visitor in the 80s cop show Contractor and Visitor.
Yeah.
So it's going to be great to see her returning to the Star Trek, or, you know, the Star Trek family again.
Oh, definitely. That was a fantastic show. I mean, it was really hard for me to decide, you know, am I going to watch T.J. Hooker, or am I going to watch Contractor and Visitor?
They were definitely competing. Whichever night that was, they were definitely competing.
They were. You know, we didn't have DVRs back in those days, so it's really hard.
Are we thinking that they're the husband and wife? They're sort of being cast, or at least the announcement's being made at the same time. Is this something we know for sure, that they're husband and wife?
Well, we don't know for sure until, you know, J.J. Abrams says, these are the characters and this is who they're playing and these are their names.
Right.
But again, the reporting that's come out, I believe also through Variety, maybe someone else said this, but that she is, oh, maybe it was EW. Anyway, they said that Contractor is going to play the wife of Clark's character.
So, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very possible we're looking at a scientist of some sort. You know, very often they have to go someplace and save a scientist or help a scientist or assist a scientist. So that could be the sort of thing. I don't know if we're looking at crew members. We were talking in the past about wanting there be more. I mean, this is something I literally said on the show, that there should be more just British crew members.
Yeah.
People
and
just,
obviously,
you know,
J.J. Abrams listens to The Ready Room, because look, right, they now cast four British actors.
I mean, Alice Eve is one thing, but now we've got Benedict Cumberbatch. We've got, yeah, I mean, it's just going on and on. I'm waiting for Hugh Laurie to be announced, you know, Stephen Fry. Who's not going to be in this film is the question. Well, that's next.
Stephen Fry is going to be there, but only in voice. He's going to be narrating all the captain's logs.
That could be perfect. You know, he was the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, so
I know.
Perhaps he could be the new ship's computer.
He also does the narration for Little Big Planet and Little Big Planet 2 on PlayStation.
Oh, wow. Oh, that'd be perfect.
Brilliant. Yeah, great stuff. So, but yeah, I think you're probably, I don't think these will be crew members here. I don't think they would have a husband and wife and young child crew member. Maybe these are characters who the Enterprise crew has to rescue from the villain.
Right. Well, it is possible this is an all-British starship, you know, the USS Pinafore.
Well, Worf will like that, because then he can brush up on his Gilbert and Sullivan. And
indeed.
That'll be great. Oh, so I don't know. It's interesting to find all this news coming out now, though. I feel like we're finally getting into that cycle where we're going to really be able to speculate more about what the movie's really going to be about. Instead of just simply who the villain is going to be.
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to start having to put all these people on pieces of paper and move them around and see what I think they might do with this cast. We're still waiting on some sort of official announcement. You know, JJ's been saying a few things to the press, but it wasn't really enough for us really to talk about on the show. Really waiting on an actual, you know, paragraph plot summary just to start getting our brains in gear. At the moment, we really have nothing to go on other than that the cast looks like it's coming together, and it looks like it's a really phenomenal cast. And I know all of my British friends have been watching Sherlock and are extremely excited that Benedict Cumberbatch is going to be in the film. So I don't know how many Americans know about this guy yet. I know Sherlock was on BBC America, but I think he's still a little bit under the radar. He may not be as well known. He's definitely not as well known as, say, Christopher Plummer or Christopher Lloyd or any of the other Christophers who have played Klingons so far.
Yeah, but of course, I think he's better known than Tom Hardy was going into Nemesis.
That is probably true, though. Yeah,
maybe a good thing, right? Not that there's anything wrong with Tom Hardy, but the casting there of someone who was very much unknown, you know, maybe. In this case, casting someone who people know and outside of the U.S. as well may help with the box office pool.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. He's not a big name in that he's going to be hard to accept. You know, a lot of people complain about Christopher Lloyd playing a Klingon, that they just can't accept him as a Klingon because they know him in so many other roles.
Yeah.
So someone maybe a little bit less known, but known enough that it gets people in theaters might be a great thing.
Yeah. I'm just disappointed it's not going to be Christopher Walken as the Tribble King. Ronald D. Moore came to be known as one of the writers who really shaped how Star Trek moved forward from The Next Generation on. And in the third season of Star Trek, he got his first chance to write in the form of The Bonding, which was the fifth episode of the third season. And today we're going to talk about The Bonding a bit and how it fits in both as a cerebral approach to Star Trek, which TNG is known for, as well as the science fiction elements. And of course, with me is Greg, and also back with us again this week is Michael Fisher. Hello, Michael. How are you?
Guys, thank you for having me on again. I'm doing well. How are you?
Now, Michael, I understand we're recording a little bit late tonight because you had an audition a little bit earlier. And I think Greg and I were talking, and I think Greg has a theory on what you were doing. And tell us if this is correct.
Yeah, Michael, were you...
I can't wait.
Let me ask. Were you auditioning for the new Star Trek film? And if so, did you use your British accent? Because I think that's the only way to get cast at this point.
Well, I use my British accent on every podcast we do, Greg. You can't hear it?
It's very subtle.
Thank you. Thank you. I deal in subtlety. No, I thought you guys might appreciate the tale of the audition, which is very brief, but the listeners, I think, would appreciate this. For about 10 years, I've wanted to do this, and I finally got to do it tonight. I was auditioning for a production of a show here in Boston, a theater production. And normally, when you audition for theater, for those of you who are not actors or not familiar with the process, you are asked often to do a monologue, which is often taken from a published play. Mm-hmm. And normally, that's what I do. But for literally a decade, ever since I started acting, I have really, really wanted to do an audition monologue using Guinan's text describing the Nexus Star Trek Generations.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. One that starts, with if you go, you're not going to care about anything. Or actually, mm-hmm. That's how it finishes. But yeah, it was like being inside joy. And tonight I just said, screw it. I'm going to do it. I just need to cross my fingers and hope that when I walk into this room, there are no young people there.
Right.
And ultimately, the director, I think, was probably about 65 or so. And I was like, yes. So I said, I'm Michael Fisher. And today I'll be doing a piece from a script called Generations by Brandon Braga and Ronald B. Moore.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And I launched into it. And a minute later, I was done. And it was well received. Wow. And I was just elated to have snuck that in there.
Oh, that's phenomenal.
Great.
It was so much fun, too. That's a wonderful, wonderful scene.
Did you go in the dreadlocks for the audition?
I didn't have time for the dreadlocks, but I had the hat. I did, yes.
I see, Michael, that you did shave your eyebrows.
Well, that's just because it's Sunday, Greg.
That's an interesting story. That's cool that you can go in and do a bit from Star Trek for the audition.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't recommend it. I'm sure I didn't get the part, and I wasn't trying to throw it away or anything like that. I just have always wanted to do it, and I'm so glad I got the opportunity.
Or maybe you will get to the part, but you'll be cast as Guinan.
Right.
That'll create a whole host of problems. I can't wait.
There's plenty of good monologues in Star Trek. I'm just thinking First Contact. You could do the speech any of the speeches that Picard says to Lily, especially, the...
Yes.
They push us and we fall back and this far, no further, and that's all that. It's pretty powerful stuff.
It really is, and especially if you can get in, if you can get the reader to read Lily's part, and you can do some Patrick Stewart lip reading.
Right.
I don't know if you know about that in that scene. If you watch it really closely, Patrick Stewart is mouthing Lily's lines.
Must
have been on like take 14 or something. Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, it's really, really
cool. The only risky thing,
just for a second,
when you do that scene for your audition, though, the only risky thing is when you throw your notebook across the stage and you knock the lights over.
Yeah.
And then the director says you broke your little lights.
Well, you broke our lights, and you now owe us for them.
Right.
Get out.
And I'm like, take it out of my pay.
It's like I remember an American Idol audition where one of the guys got on the show and he got so excited he jumped up and he didn't do it on purpose, but the chair goes flying off the back of the stage. And they ask him, are you going to pay for that, right? As a joke. But,
that's great.
All right. Well, let's talk about The Bonding here a little bit. And so... Greg, why don't you start us off? Because I know you wanted to talk about the fact that this was Ronald D. Moore's first Star Trek script.
Right. So I guess the background information for this is that Michael Piller came in as the producer in season three. And Michael Piller is a whole other story that we really should save for another podcast. But he basically, what he says is that they didn't have that many stories going in. You know, they'd run out of phase two scripts. They'd run out of those, you know, when they had pitched the show to the network or to, you know, the powers that be, they had a certain number of scripts that they said they're going to do these, and they had some other ideas along the way. But going to season three, they really didn't have anything. And that's a really terrifying way to start a season, especially as a new showrunner. And he said basically there was this spec script sitting around by this aspiring young writer named Ronald D. Moore, who we were just talking about because he turns out to be the guy who ended up writing Generations along with his writing partner, Brandon Braga. He also wrote First Contact. We talked about it. He kind of ran Deep Space Nine for many years as well as being a staff member of TNG. What I think a lot of people don't go back to realize is that this career started with this script for The Bonding. So we were talking about this a little bit before the show, but it's essentially fan fiction. You know, it's Ronald Moore was watching the first season, the beginning of the second season, looking at these characters and thinking, you know, I love Star Trek. I think these characters are interesting, but what's some interesting things that we can actually do with them? You know, how can we use these characters in a way they haven't been used with and tell a story that's about more than just, you know, floating space alien of the week? And the script he came up with is The Bonding, which I think is a script, it's a show that's not well remembered. So I thought it'd be worth us talking about it this week. Did both of you guys get a chance to watch it before we recorded?
Yeah, I watched it yesterday, kind of passively, and then I watched it again today and kind of took some notes as I went through. And it is, I like Floating Space Alien of the Week as a description of some of the earlier Next Generation. You know, The Next Generation came to be known as a rather cerebral series, a very, you know, introspective series into human condition. And, you know, it's a very talky show and Picard's very philosophical character a lot of the times. And the first half of this episode, definitely, you do get that. It's kind of a point where Ronald D. Moore did come in and bring that into Star Trek here. It's not that it never happens prior to this, but it's very noticeable here. And you mentioned phase two scripts also, Greg, mm-hmm. and you do get that feeling in a lot of the first and second season of The Next Generation. You do feel like there's a lot of either kind of mimicking TOS while trying to be its own thing, but still the story kind of has that feeling. Mm-hmm. Or you get these phase two scripts, which obviously are a lot like TOS because it was supposed to be a continuation, you know, of that concept.
Right.
So yeah, I was watching this and noticing how TNG this story feels.
Right.
It came along at exactly the right time. Or I mean, I guess, you know, Ronald Moore did, because if this had been a second season script, you know, or if it had been a first season script, I mean, it would have been just so different. Because this is, what is this, the fifth episode mm-hmm. into the third mm-hmm. season?
Yeah, that's right.
And we're seeing already some of these massive changes that TNG undergoes. You know, there are so many nice little touches in this episode. And it's kind of, in a lot of ways, this episode is a perfect hybrid between the earlier kind of, as you were saying, Chris, the ostentatious TOS episodes. All you have to do is listen to the music to
right.
see how it, you know, that is still represented somewhat in the music. That it's kind of, it's not this acoustic wallpaper that it later becomes, this very uninteresting stuff, but it is also not the first season's rambunctious, overriding, explosive, you know,
right, yeah.
tones.
Yeah.
And and I think that, you know, as a metaphor for speaking about the episode in general, I mean, it's a wonderful little hybrid between, it's at TNG's midpoint here.
Yeah.
And we start to see some amazing stuff. And I'm glad it came along, this script came along when it did.
Yeah. I mean, I really feel like Star Trek was getting into a bit of a rut with TNG. You know, you watch those first and second season episodes, it's they come across a problem, have a staff meeting, do some technobabble, start to fix it, and then it gets worse. You have another staff meeting, and you fix it a little bit more, and you're done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's really the mold that a lot of the scripts fell into. And what struck me right off the bat about this episode is that there are no staff meetings. You know, Dork Trek likes to make fun of them. You know, the staff meeting.
Of course, because they always happen.
They always have staff meetings, and they're not the most interesting things. You know, directors hate when you have like 8 characters in a room that all have to talk and have to do all this coverage. And I don't know why they kept going back to it, but I guess, you know, give a problem and have each of your characters in a row say what they think they do to fix it. But it's not the best way, I think, dramatically to tell a story. You know, the real thing to do is to come to a story and see who would be interesting to actually deal with this problem. You know, who among our cast can actually do this? You know, not everyone has to be in every show, or at least they don't have to be featured in every show. I guess we should explain for those who haven't seen The Bonding recently, it's a story where Worf is leading an away mission, and it's a supposedly a dead planet, but a bomb goes off, and one of his subordinates is killed instantly in the explosion. And then it turns out that because the Enterprise is a family ship, her son is actually on board, and Jeremy Astor. And his father was also killed, I believe, 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, 5 years earlier.
In another mission. And, you know, the whole episode is sort of about how Jeremy deals with the death, how Worf deals with the death. It's, you know, even when Yar died, you know, they actually talk about Yar dying a little bit in this, but I don't feel like they really went to this extent of grieving. We can talk about the second half of the show in a minute. I actually want to talk about some stuff there, but they spend a good 20 minutes of this show simply grieving and simply dealing with the grieving about this crew member's death.
Yeah, I have to admit, at some points I was thinking that this episode should have been called "How's That Working for You?" because it reminded me a little bit of like a Dr. Phil show where it's like Troy's running around the ship counseling everybody and like, how do you feel? How do you feel? You know, and like, you know, Worf looks really upset and I sense anger and you know, Picard is in the turbo lift.
You see, Worf, you can't lead an away mission with a bear. You know, you got to leave the bear at home, and then you got to go on the away mission. Now look into her eyes. Look into her eyes and tell her that.
Oh, God. Oh, I haven't seen a single episode of Dr. Phil, and now I will make sure to continue that trend in my life.
Oh, gosh. But you know, you do say, Greg, that this is an episode where Troy actually does have something to do, because you know, you always wonder, well, why is there a counselor as a member of the senior staff? And Troy, I mean, you can kind of guess, well, yeah, they're on, you know, a deep space mission. I mean, the ship is designed to go on like missions of 10 or 12 years, I think, without returning to a starbase, I think is what the Galaxy class was designed to be able to do. They obviously don't, but it's the concept is very long term, and that's why families are on the ship. And of course, you know, it can be traumatic. Yeah. Traveling in space, and so it makes sense that you would have a counselor, but she doesn't necessarily get to do meaningful counseling very much up to this point in the show.
Yeah. I mean, Picard makes the comment, which I think is actually Ronald Moore's comment, that it's kind of a questionable practice of having families on board the ship, you know, because all of these people didn't sign up for this, you know. The people who signed up for Starfleet, their families didn't also sign up to be thrown into the neutral zone. And this is something I've always heard from Ronald Moore as he talks about Battlestar Galactica, about how the Enterprise D had families, and it was something they had to deal with because, you know, Gene Roddenberry put families on there. But it was always a question of, you know, why, really? And it's a real question. But I guess I did want to ask you guys what you thought of that. You know, I guess it wouldn't be good for Jeremy to be left on Earth when his mom dies in a deep space mission. It might be better for him to be there and have seen her the day before and be able to have the counselor there to help him through it.
Right. I think it goes back to what Chris mentioned about the Galaxy class, you know, design and mission profile. I mean, it was designed for these very, very long excursions. And I guess the question then becomes, when you're designing something like that, whether you're in universe or if you're writing for the show, well, that they're going to be away from their families for like 7 years.
Yeah.
Well, why not take them along? The ship is big enough, theoretically, when it was being built, everyone thought it was safe enough. Of course, we found out later that these things are just death traps. But, you know, so why not bring families along if we can design the ship to accommodate them? And I think that was a cool, bold, you know, break from the original series where the ship is essentially, you know, a destroyer or something right. like yeah. that. Or, you know, no, it's a heavy cruiser, but I mean, you know, in today's.
I think it's a question of what is Starfleet? You know, is Starfleet a military organization or is Starfleet a scientific organization? And the Galaxy class starship and the whole mission of the Next Generation kind of, it kind of pretends to be an exploratory vessel that they're just going to be on science missions all the time. Mm-hmm. Whereas in reality, I mean, if that's all they did on the TV show, it'd be a really boring TV show, right? I
right.
mean, you don't want to just watch them go catalog gaseous anomalies all the time, right? Or check out plants or things like that. So obviously they're going to have conflicts. And so then you get into the question, well, is Starfleet a military organization? You know, the Starfleet of Deep Space Nine seems to be very much a military organization, whereas the Starfleet of early Next Generation, and maybe all pretty much all Next Generation, seems to be more of a scientific organization. And if it's if they're just going to be exploring, then it makes perfect sense, that you take your family with you because, you know, it's going to be safe. It's a huge, very powerful state-of-the-art vessel. And you don't want to be separated from your family for 10 years. But knowing the dangers that are inherent in that, it has to be hard. I mean, if you're a Starfleet officer and you have children, I mean, making that decision, as a parent, do you want to take your children with you in the first place? I mean, you don't want to be apart from them, but at the same time, you know, you're putting them into danger by taking them out into deep space.
And where are you taking them from as well? I mean, you're taking them from Earth, which, as we later learn, thanks to DS9, is paradise.
Right.
There's no crime. There's no poverty. There's no anything. There's nothing bad about life on Earth. So, yeah, it I guess it is a very important question. But we see other parents do it on other ships as well. Annika Hansen on, you know, on the Raven. And I forgot his name, but the kid on the Vico who loses his whole family and then wants to be Little Data.
Right.
Yeah.
You know. So, it seems to be a fleet-wide thing. And I think Starfleet is an organization that is pseudo-military until it's backed into a corner and needs to be a war-fighting, organization.
Well, what is it that Pike says in the new Star Trek film? It's a diplomatic and scientific organization or something. It's the first time they actually they actually set down, you know, what Starfleet is. Because, it has been kind of nebulous, you know. The Enterprise spends most of season one ferrying diplomats between various worlds. Spends most of season two getting infected, it seems like, by really bizarre viruses that cause people to age or hallucinate. I mean, eventually, they do start going to war. I mean, you think about these Borg stories where they're going into battle with the Borg and the families are just there. You know, in theory, they could split the saucer section away and do the battle, but they never really do that, I guess, for budgetary reasons. But nevertheless, the families are there. But they do make a good point, you know, even if they are just doing scientific things, you know, this was not supposed to be a dangerous mission. You know, Jeremy wasn't sitting, you know, by his iPad wondering if his mom was going to make it home in time. He fully expected her to come back because it was just a routine mission. And and I think that's something that this really tries to touch on is that no mission, nothing that we do in life is perfectly safe. You know, there are always dangers. And I guess an interesting thing to me here is how Jeremy deals with it and then how Troy helps him deal with it. The fact that Jeremy does actually take it kind of well, you know, at least at first, he's not lashing out. He is saying, I understand. And I think that part of that is like the 24th century, but part of it might just be he's a kid. Yeah.
Let me ask you this about that. So it does look like Jeremy's taking it very well initially. He's like being strong. I mean, Troy even goes and she tells Picard that he's being very brave and Picard says, good, you know, and Troy's like, no, it's not good. It's not.
Right. Right.
I mean, another question here again, as we delve into this, I mean, again, this is, you know, very end of the 80s. It's very much this in America at the time. It was all this get in touch with your feelings and, you know, you have to talk and talk and talk about things. Is it that Jeremy had been prepared because he talks about how at school they prepare us for death and they, you know, they tell us about these dangers on the missions that, you know, that our parents might go through. Was he taking it okay, but Troy as a counselor, like that wasn't good enough for her. And so she has to drum it up like, well, no. It's not okay. And then let's talk more and more and more about it. And then he starts to kind of fall apart to the point where he starts buying into this whole alien thing, which
right.
he had to know that that was an alien, which we can talk a bit about later on, you know, in the right. discussion here. But for right now, do you think that he really was taking it well, and then because Troy wanted to keep talking about it, it changed? Or do you think he was just kind of trying to be tough and cover it up?
Yeah. Well, Troy definitely, Troy was running around the ship trying to fix things. You know, she told Picard.
She's like, I have something to do, finally.
Exactly.
Now, this is why I was here.
Yeah, she got a whole season's worth of work.
I knew there was a reason I signed onto this ship.
But she has an interesting speech to Picard where she talks about having or trying to bring people back to a place of joy.
Yes.
And that's her goal. And that's really actually quite interesting, you know, a sort of a mission statement for Troy that I've not heard before. And the fact that, yeah, she does, I think she recognizes that there's a danger in the way Jeremy's taking it. It'd be a good time for me to talk about the original script to the bonding. What we actually saw on screen is not exactly what he wrote originally. As it goes in this script, there's this alien from the planet, this energy being that masquerades as his mother. And it becomes, you know, how do we get Jeremy to reject this when she's so real? The original script actually had Jeremy going into the holodeck. He was not accepting the death. He was, you know, outwardly pretending to be, but sort of like Barclay, he was sneaking off to the holodeck to recreate his mother, recreate his home on Earth, and sort of just live out the rest of his life there. And that became a much more difficult thing for Troy to overcome. You know, this kid who's pretending his mom's still alive.
Yeah.
You know, he's telling everyone, oh, I'm fine. I'm just, you know, enjoying. And we see a little bit of that here where he's, as we said, watching his iPad of those old home movies. He's obviously not really moving on, you know, like he says he is, which is fine. His mom just died. He doesn't need to move on.
So that original script is a lot what we get in DS9. With It's Only a Paper Moon, when
Nog
goes in and shacks up with Vic and is going to kind of hide out in the holodeck, like what happened to him and his leg isn't real. Yeah. And then they have to overcome that, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a much more interesting story when you are when the victim puts himself into that situation. I think I did not know that about the rewrite. Mm-hmm. I think that is a more compelling story.
Yeah.
You know. Instead of a replacement mother being foisted on you, which I guess we'll talk about in a second, but then you create it yourself, and then the challenge becomes overcoming your own impulse to live in your fantasy world.
Right, and
that's interesting.
It was Pillar's idea of the energy being, but it was basically Roddenberry coming in and just saying, "Kids would accept the death better than you're showing." And also there was a thought that they'd done the holodeck a few too many times and they needed to do something different.
No,
and I understand those things.
That can't be right.
I would like to go back. I don't remember actually who wrote It's Only Paper Moon at this point. I'd wonder if that was more going back and saying, you know, what if I did the bonding the original way I intended it? I wouldn't be surprised if I know he was on the show at that point. So I bet there is a relation between these two scripts. Because as you say, that is a more interesting idea. It's how does he deal with it? Because he turns into a very passive person in this script. You know, there's the first 21 minutes where he's trying to deal with it and Troy's talking to him and Wesley comes. But as soon as the being shows up, he's basically just going along for the ride. And it's not until the very end of it where he lashes out at Picard, or at Worf, sorry, that it becomes actually interesting again.
Yeah, well, and that's when it becomes really interesting, when it only toward the very end of the episode do we start to explore these really, really deep concepts of there's wonderful gold nuggets of quotes from this episode. You know, the alien mother is saying, I will be every bit his mother, mm-hmm. Picard's response, but not his mother.
Exactly, right.
And which leads me to think, it's like, well, how real does she need to be? I mean, what is, you know, and they didn't really explore this. This is me kind of going off on a tangent in my own mind. But then they don't even give any time to do that, because then the next thing they bring up in less than a minute is, what is so noble about sorrow, she says. Why must this be respected, this grieving process, if he can just have her back in me? Fascinating argument.
And at the very end,
ready to respond as quickly.
Yeah. Just right after that little exchange between the alien and Picard there, and Picard tells the alien, that we are mortal and our time in this universe is finite. And that's one of the truths that all humans must learn. But that comes at the very, I think there are like 3 minutes left in the episode at that point. Because we spent 20 minutes on this whole alien energy Casper the Ghost thing chasing O'Brien down the corridor, you know, instead of continuing to explore the issue. Now, I don't know if, I guess what we've just come to here is that we would have rather seen the original concept where he's kind of going into the holodeck, because I was thinking that this episode, it's like the two halves of The Next Generation. Mm-hmm. It's like you've got the very cerebral, let's talk about the human condition for the first 20 minutes. And the second 20 minutes, we've got the, you know, the energy alien problem. We have to tech the tech solution to get out of here kind of thing going on. And would you have wanted to see it just continue to be this kind of counseling and talking the whole time, but maybe you need something else? Because I felt like it got a little bit, I was kind of glad to see the alien appear just because I felt like it was not going anywhere. It was too much of Troy running around talking to different people about how they feel about things, and we weren't actually getting anywhere.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I want to, real quick before we move on, what did you think of all those scenes? I think, Mike, you had something to say about the scene between Troy and Worf when they had the grate in front of the camera for the entire scene.
Right. Yeah, that scene is peculiar to me because I actually saw a bit of it a couple days ago when I was researching this episode for pad reasons.
Right. Yeah.
Because Jeremy uses the pad in a really great way. And, but I came across that scene. I'm like, why are they talking in the computer core set or whatever wherever the hell it was? Like, I think that's what that was,
Because
that was introduced in Evolution, I think.
Okay.
At the top of this season.
It's because Troy was running around the ship trying to find each person to ask them how they felt about the situation, and Worf just happened to be in there at that
Worf just happened to be in there throwing floppy disks around or something. I don't know what, you know. It's peculiar that that scene was set in there, and I the camera guy did have to do a lot to keep Troy's face in frame through one of those grill ports, which was an interesting thing. Right. But I don't know. I feel like I feel like that is an element of some production stuff that I would like to mention again. But you know, I think it was you, Greg, who tweeted last night, or maybe it was you, Chris, who said Worf is pacing angrily, stalking about the room, and Troy's line is like, "I sense great anger into you."
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's like, oh, you're awesome.
Greg was
Deanna.
Tweeting
Good
things
job.
Happening in the episode, and I was replying as Troy. If you notice, I signed all the tweets as Troy.
Right. That's pretty good.
I think Greg said something like, the problem with this episode is that it just takes so long for something to happen. And I tweeted back, I sense impatience, or maybe it's just boredom. Signed, Troy.
Oh, but you couldn't tell because of all the other crew's emotions.
Yes, it's hard to filter those
out. That's right. When that happened, I was like, what?
But the scene between Troy and Worf, the title of the episode is The Bonding. And I'm hoping that someone can explain to me what the bonding is. I feel like when Dork Trek gets to this episode, they're going to have a field day. Because Worf has a one-track mind, and I don't know what it's a one-track mind about. He keeps saying, I want to do the bonding. I want to bond with the boy. And Troy's like, just wait. He's not ready. And he's an orphan. Okay. He'll understand. I'm not even trying to make a joke out of it. I feel like Worf just keeps going on and on about it, and it's never properly explained. So, Chris, do you have a good explanation?
I think you're reading too much into it, Greg. It's all summed up at the end of the episode. The bonding, it's very simple. It's just a Klingon ceremony in which you line up candles and then you talk to them and you become brothers for life. That's it. It's very simple. You only utter one line, which, by the way, I've got to give props to Jeremy Astor because this boy can pick Klingon up really
quickly.
That was
really impressive, yeah.
Oh,
I mean, Worf only said it one time. And Jeremy repeated it flawlessly. Great, you know. It kind of reminded me.
That's what he learns in school when he's learning about death.
Yeah, you know, there's this episode of Alf where Alf, he burned a cookbook or burned a book. He burned a history book, I think it was.
And he's
going to have like, 100 years of bad luck or something because he burned this book. And he has to do some kind of Melmacian ceremony to kind of repent for this horrible thing he's done. Because, like, the worst thing you can do on Melmac is burn a history book. And so he puts the Tanners through this whole big, long production. And they have to, like, wear meat. And they have, like, stakes hanging around their necks and things. And in the end, yes. All it was that Alf just goes, "Sorry about the book." And that was it. And they're like, "That's it? We did all of this? Sorry about the book?" And that's kind of at the end of this episode when they finally do the bonding. I'm like, wait, you just lined right. up like 8 candles, lit them, and you said one sentence and you're done? That's right. The bonding?
And that was this big...
Well, you are forgetting... There's a critical element of the whole ceremony that is not shown on screen, is that after you do that, after you have the bonding ceremony, you can never see the boy again.
That's right.
He is just sent upstairs right. like the youngest Winslow or whoever.
Well, yeah. I mean, Memory Alpha has a few, you know, Ron Moore back in the day did AOL chats with fans. There's a lot of great nuggets that come out of those.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
A couple of them, you know, people asked, you know, when are you going to go back to Jeremy Astor? When are you going to see Astor again? And he basically said, "I don't have another interesting story. You know, I did my story, mm-hmm. and yeah, I mean, Worf's bonded with him for life, but where do you go from there? You know, you show him in 2 years and he's fine. Is he the new Wesley? It doesn't seem like there's much to do with him." But it is really bizarre that after this whole buildup, you know, this huge buildup of Worf wanting to bond with him and take him under his wing, that it's immediately dropped. And I guess that just says a lot to the fact that this is a spec script, that it's an episodic series and not a serialized one.
Well, they could have done, you know, there were a number of episodes later on Next Generation where they had Alexander on the ship and they had to try to find things to do with Alexander.
Right.
And I mean, we could have explored, you know, Alexander getting to know his uncle because Worf and Jeremy became brothers for life. And
Uncle Jeremy.
Yeah, you know, hang out on the holodeck together. That could be like Jake and Nog. They could sneak in to some of Riker's holodeck programs.
Dear. I wouldn't want to sneak DS9 in on one of Riker's holodeck programs.
I was going to say, sneaking in, man, you know.
That's a whole...
It's just Riker just creates whole rooms full of trombones, sultry women, and things to lean on.
Things to lean on, right? Because sometimes your shoulder gets tired from leaning that way, and you need to just prop it up, right?
Exactly. You need to aggressively lean on something else in a different way and squint at something else.
And point. And point as he...
And point. Oh, and point as he... Oh, yes! No, that was that wasn't this one, though. That was... What was it? The evolution, right?
I think it was from Evolution, where he points at Wesley as he walks all the way from the turbo lift.
From the turbo lift all the way to the con.
Anyway, oh gosh!
As we're talking about Uncle Jeremy, is this a good time to mention how kids on Star Trek look like tiny adults?
Yes.
Yeah, they do.
I don't know if it's the way they're wardrobed and they do their hair. It's really, they don't look like kids somehow.
Well, speaking of that, Greg, you know, this is a little known fact about this episode. I don't even think Memory Alpha has this. that this is actually, you know, these days product placement on television shows is just incredible. I mean, I think we had Desperate Housewives on here the other day, I think it was. And it's like every time they're getting bags out of the trunk of the car and it's got a big Sprint logo on the bag. You know,
right.
It's just everywhere. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But this is one of the earliest examples of product placement in television, and certainly on Star Trek. This was an episode that was apparently sponsored by Brill Cream.
Mm-hmm. It's big old, exactly. nice clean part there, and a good greasy sheen all over.
They
German
were launching
hair.
A new product called Brill Cream Jr., Brill Cream for kids. And
Space Brill Cream Jr., yeah.
And apparently Jeremy Astor was the spokesperson for Brill Cream here.
Well, this is why Jeremy needed his mom so much, because she was the one who combed his hair, you know, perfectly every morning.
Very, very critical role
to
play in a young boy's evolution. I used Brill Cream when I was a kid.
Oh, wow.
I actually did. I had a tube of Brill Cream. What a horrible concoction.
I just remember that my grandfather always had Brill Cream on the counter.
Wow.
At their house. But you're right, Greg. It is true that in Star Trek, the kids do typically look like miniature adults,
right.
Which is why Rascals was kind of hard to tell. Are these the shrunken crew members? Or are these just kids that happen to be on the ship?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it, would you be, you're sitting in my chair. I couldn't stand young Picard's voice. It drove me
perfect.
Nuts.
But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I really would love to get the original script to the bonding, because I feel like without the weird production design, without the creepy looking kid, without the weird sci-fi element, what was Geordi's line? I hope it they don't blow us up while trying to figure out how to blow us up.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And Elwin Geordi says, it's checking out the computer everywhere, going to school.
Like, that's obviously Michael Piller. That's not Ronald Moore. I would state
aliens going to school.
I would probably go with you on that one. Yeah.
So it's like Geordi doesn't have anything to do. LeVar is very angry. Let's give him a couple of cool lines to give.
That's right.
But I feel like the original script does do what we're saying. You know, the very end of the episode. I don't know if it's worth the previous 38 minutes, but the end is really fantastic where they really break it down. And Picard, it's not a Picard speech, but it's a Picard conversation where he's talking.
It's a Picard debate.
A Picard debate. That's exactly the right way to put it. And I wonder if in the original script he had the same debate with the holodeck mom. Maybe she had become, you know, pseudo-sentient like Moriarty.
Yeah,
maybe. You know, that's definitely something that they could do.
Yeah, it was the last 10 minutes of the episode was like very, very – it was theater for Jeremy, right? I mean, we have Counselor Troy over there prompting everybody to – you know, and I think we haven't talked much about Wesley in this,
this
episode. Oh,
yeah, that's really – we should.
But it is so important, obviously, to it and, you know, for reasons that are obvious if you've seen the episode. But it Will Wheaton, I think this is the first time in Star Trek I've seen him have the opportunity – to just kind of be a normal kid who went through something really profound when he lost his dad. And he does such a great job with it. And the scene where he and Gates McFadden talk before this scene, when they talk in sickbay about their feelings, when we're still in the first half of the episode, so we're still dealing with emotions. I mean, it's wonderful. And it's one of the first times we see these subtle moments that are able to happen in Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And that's one of these really amazing moments that is kind of undermined by the music at that point, because I think synthesizers were not yet completely written out. So, but you know, they both have a really great ability to shine with very subtle stuff, and they weren't given it much up to this point.
And
Wesley confronting Picard at the end, there, you know, I was angry with you,
right?
I mean, that it would have been very easy for that to be a very melodramatic moment, but it's not.
Well, that was a good moment. I guess my question about Wesley in this episode is that should they have waited until the very, very last moment? And he actually still, I assume he talks to Jeremy after the episode and, you know, maybe they get to know each other and he can help Jeremy through all this. But should they have waited until the very, very last moment of the episode to actually have Wesley do something related to Jeremy? And he even then didn't really talk to Jeremy. He finally like let out something he had been feeling about Picard for all this time. Or should they have gotten Wesley more involved earlier on in the episode instead of him being kind of unwilling to participate in what was going on for the whole episode?
Well,
I think it was true to the character that he was unwilling to participate for so long, because he just, I mean, who wants to talk about that? I don't know. I don't know what it's like to lose a parent, but I wouldn't want to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, for all our complaints about Wesley, he does often act like an actual person. You go back to Evolution, and, you know, in Dork Trek, they were complaining that he doesn't go right away to Picard to say, you know, it's my fault, the ship's blowing up. But, you know, if I were in that situation, and especially if I were a kid, and I'd be so nervous. You know, Picard already doesn't like me that much. I was trying really hard to be good and to be an ensign, and I really screwed things up. I wouldn't go to the captain right away. And that's sort of the same situation here. You know, his mom's making him aware that he'd be really helpful, but he doesn't feel that he could really do it. You know, it's such, you know, the way Troy is sort of tiptoeing around Jeremy, you know, even when the mom's there, you know, Picard says, you know, don't interfere, you know. They're trying so hard to not throw Jeremy in one way or the other. You know, they didn't beam him into a, you know, confinement and make sure that no one can talk to him. it was so important to keep a hold on his emotions. And I think Wesley didn't feel that he was up to it, you know, that he could have that good effect on it. You know, Worf was determined, you know, if I do this bonding, that's going to fix everything.
And yeah, right. It's easy. Just two candles.
Right.
Fixed.
He's on yeah. one end of the spectrum and Wesley's on the other. You know, Wesley yeah. says, I don't know what I can do to help Jeremy. You know, I went through it, but I'm still dealing with it. And I think it was at the very end when Troy made them both realize, you know, you both are still dealing with the emotions. You know, Wesley is still dealing with it at this point. It's okay to have these emotions. And that's when Jeremy was able to, you know, have the epiphany. And I think if Wesley had gotten involved too soon, A, it wouldn't have been true to Wesley's character. And B, it would have, you know, fixed things a little too soon. What he really needed wasn't as much the bonding. What he needed was to see someone else who had gone through a very similar experience and had dealt with it and had turned out, you know, had turned out okay at least. I think Wesley was really the key in this episode.
Yeah. Another thing with characters that I did want to mention just briefly here is that in this episode, we do see more caring from Picard, I think. You know, mm-hmm. Picard famously yeah. doesn't oh, yeah. like children and all. But what I took away from this is that ultimately he does care very much, obviously, for the members of his crew. But it seemed especially so for the children. You know, as a parent, I know how I feel about children, whether they're my children or other children, just knowing their place in the world, their level of experience in life, and, you know, how the support that they need. And you see that from Picard here, which I think you mm-hmm. didn't really see before this point in Star Trek. Yeah. And you do see later, you know, Picard always remains this kind of above the fray kind of captain. But this was a moment where I thought it was good character development, even though it was brief character yeah. development for Picard here too.
Well, that's very brief, but he leaves us with a wonderful quote as well, because Picard is the guy who is going to do the right thing no matter what, particularly in moments when it is painful, when it is a painful right mm-hmm. thing to do. And we were talking a little bit about the deep thoughts at the end of the episode, but he leaves us with this wonderful line, which is not very complicated. It's a very simple idea, but he says, what you're offering him is a memory.
Right.
Something to cherish, not to live in. And, you know, I mean, that is, I think probably if you had to distill problems with Western psyches down to like a list of maybe 10 or 12, you know, that's up there.
Yeah.
And to have Jeff Picard say that, you know, this kind of paragon of authority and steadfast moral certitude to say that, I mean, you can't help but agree with him.
Yeah.
And of course, then the alien mother realizes it and disappears. So
yeah,
Picard's tongue wins out again.
Good
but,
job.
You know, it, with a very good point.
We have a show title
right
there.
That stuck with me.
Yeah.
Ah. Hey. All right.
But yeah, I mean, that leads us to talking about the fact, all the things that led to this episode. You know, you look at this crew and you look at the ship and the fact that your captain lost his best friend and he had to bring his body home to the wife and the kid and deal with that. And then they're on the ship with him and he has to deal with it every day. And Worf lost his family. The whole crew just lost Tasha Yar not a year ago. And it's not dealt with that much. And I've been thinking about Battlestar Galactica and obviously another show written by Ronald Moore. And before the series begins, the main character, I don't know who's the main character, but the brother or the son, Zach, actually dies. And he's the fiance of one of the characters, the brother of another, the son of the commander. And the fact that everyone is still dealing with that, you know, even as the show progresses, even a season and a half into the show, they're still dealing with the death of this guy who was so important to everyone, really is very realistic. And it's the sort of thing that this episode of TNG deals with. And I wish they'd done more with it. You know, I don't know how many episodes you could have dealing with it, but surely there would have been a place for Wesley all through the show to be dealing with his father's death and dealing with Picard's role in that. And it's kind of astonishing that it took till the beginning of season 3 and a freelance writer bringing in a spec script for them to truly deal with these issues. It's extremely unrealistic the way they had dealt with it up till this point.
Well, I think that's where it's hard to deal with these types of things on The Next Generation because it was so much every episode is, you know, this week a story, this week a story.
Self-contained little bottle.
It's where I think a concept like Deep Space Nine works better for this aspect of Star Trek, of exploring these issues of humanity in Star Trek. Having a serialized show like Deep Space Nine would allow you to do that, as opposed to The Next Generation, where they really, because even if they did deal with it later on, I mean, someone pops into episode 120 and there's reference to this, you know, and then you were just wondering, well, why is this character,
right,
you know, grieving about this?
I feel like the one way to deal with it in an episodic, you know, show like Next Generation is kind of what they do here. This episode serves kind of the same purpose as Lower Decks does later on, in a different context, because Lower Decks is meant to show us what life is like every day for these underlings you see walking around in the corridors that never get a name or anything like that. But we are meant to assume that this is kind of what their life is like. This is a little slice of life of all those people. And even though we don't see it in every episode, that's what's going on in every episode behind the scenes. So I kind of got the takeaway on this episode that whenever we lose crew members, which happens pretty often, even in Next Generation, red shirts are always, you know, ending up dead somehow, that this process does go on. We just don't see it because we're focused on the action of whatever the given episode is at the time.
Right. And that does make an awful lot of sense. And I guess that's what Troy talks about with Picard, how he says, you know, you're always dealing with something like this. And you're right. You know, maybe you can't have this episode every week. And it is great that this exists. I sort of hope that us talking about the show today is going to remind people of the show's existence and of its importance. Because I feel like it does...
Yeah.
As far as Wesley's background and Picard's background and Crusher's background and Worf's background and Troy's background, this is maybe the first episode that deals with all of them and their backgrounds and their stories in a way that feels organic and realistic. And it is sort of a placeholder. It makes up for the fact that they don't really do it for the rest of the show. So... You know, maybe if you just hold this episode in your mind and just remember, you know, Wesley is dealing with all of this and Picard is dealing with all this. And there is more going on with their characters than maybe we see every week. You know, maybe the reason Troy can't sense, you know, whatever the alien of the week is feeling is because she just had a really difficult counseling session, you know, with the kid who just lost both of his parents in a science mission. You know, she's got a lot she's actually dealing with that maybe we don't actually see from week to week.
Good point.
Yeah, it's true. You do have to think about the fact that we see, 168 episodes of the series where their mission actually spans 7 years. So we are just seeing like the cherry-picked moments of their life aboard the Enterprise. So you do, I mean, it's tough as a fan to fill that in because you just focus on what you see on the screen. But then if you want to put it within a realistic context, you do remember that, you know, there are 365 days every year for 7 years. They're out there flying around and life happens all the time, you know. And
we have to assume that after Yar's death, they sort of went to a space station and just sat there for a month or so and everyone talked with Troy and, you know, that's a lot of people talking to Troy. But you got to figure, even though we don't see it, it did happen, you know, that these people did have to deal with her death. And we can tell from this episode that they're still dealing with it even later. You know, even Data, who doesn't actually have a soul, is still dealing with Yara's death.
But, you know, that was an interesting thing in here that it happens so quickly, you can just kind of miss it. But, you know, Data actually admits to Riker that he doesn't feel the same sense of emptiness or loss with Lieutenant Astor that he feels with Yar, but he doesn't know why because he's still learning about human emotions and all. But even he, as an android, there's like something going on in his programming that feels different to him when it comes to Yar versus Lieutenant Astor.
And he follows up on that later in it's not Time's Arrow, it's a later episode where he says, as I experience certain sensory input patterns, my mental pathways become accustomed to them.
Right.
The inputs are eventually anticipated and even missed when absent. And so this is Data, like, having a computer conversation about missing somebody.
Right. Yes.
And, you know, and then, well, and then is that any less real than one of us having, you know, missing chemical impulses
right.
when somebody else is missing? Well, I don't know if that's less valid at all, yeah. I think. Of course, I love Data, so, you know. But
yeah,
it is fascinating to see him wrestling with that.
Yeah, definitely.
That scene that you mentioned, Chris, is a very short scene, and it's very cool and ten forward. We get an interesting little window into Riker there,
mm-hmm.
Because as we often talk about, Riker's kind of a ladies' man, and he has a very interesting answer to Data's question. Data's like, "Did you know Lieutenant Astor well?" And Riker kind of does one of his Jonathan Frakes lascivious smiles and is like, "We spent some time together."
Yeah, I know. That's what I was thinking too when that line came out.
Man.
And then I think the follow-up question is something like, you know, Data's like, "Did you know her well?" And Riker's like, not terribly well." And I'm like, okay.
All right.
That's, you know, all right. And then Riker never interacts with Jeremy Astor once.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm on duty. I'm gonna go.
Not going to be a surrogate father.
Yeah, I noticed that line too. Yeah.
I mean, that was another one of those moments, that little conversation between Data and Riker, that gave me the sense that this was someone who had been thinking about this script for a while. This wasn't a writer's room script. This wasn't something developed, you know, over a week and a half because they needed to have an episode 17. This was somebody who had been thinking about loss and death and humanity, and had some really interesting things that he wanted to say. And I love it because it adds so much depth to people like Riker, where he admits, you know, as we say, that Astor doesn't mean as much to him as Yar did. And that's true for everyone on the bridge. You know, they're dealing with it, but it's not as big a deal. And that's kind of an astonishing thing for network television to say. You know, you expect them to say, well, you know, every life is important and let's, you know, drum that beat. But Riker's admitting it's not really true. And it's really, really quite profound and sad in some way, but it is true.
Well,
and it's just one of many things like that in the show.
I don't know if he's exactly saying that's true, but he's saying that it's true or not true from each person's perspective. It's for you, each is not equally important.
Exactly. Right. It's true that humans do this,
for
that humans place more importance on people they know very well than people they don't. And whether that's good or bad or whatever, it's true. And I think he says it's okay, you know, the Data doesn't need to feel bad. I mean, he says, you know, maybe we'd have fewer
it's
wars,
natural.
But
at
the same time, he's not saying we need to fix it and we need to all go, you know, convince ourselves that everything. He's saying, you know, to be a human means certain things.
It's how the world works. It's
that's
the natural way of things.
Even though it's not terribly appealing to think about.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this was interesting to talk about and definitely plants the seeds of what Next Generation, I think, becomes over the course of the series. And what when people think back now about the Next Generation, it's this type of story that and character interaction, I think, that defines the series. So, you know, chances are a lot of our listeners probably haven't seen this episode in a very long time because it's, again, not one that you tend to watch over and over. So we encourage everybody to go back and watch this one, you know, and watch for those things that we talked about here.
Just pretend that all the scenes with Jeremy and his mother are, you know, in the holodeck. Just fudge the edges a little bit and you can almost make it work.
Yeah, which would have worked better than the whole aliens feeling bad, like it's our duty to make him happy now.
Right.
Right. I mean, for an episode that's dealing so much with humanity, it's not that great to deal with an alien's grief. You know, we don't need to know that the energy beings feel bad about this. That's
right.
That's not what's important here. What's important is how Jeremy's dealing with it, how the crew's dealing with it.
I think at that point, there was still a feeling like it can't be Star Trek if it doesn't have that type of alien
of the week,
element to it. If this story had been done in season 6 or 7, maybe right. they would not have felt the need to have that element in the story.
It did give them an opportunity a little bit to showcase kind of the attention to detail of the more minor, much more minor stuff in the show. But it's stuff that you can watch. If you watch Star Trek closely enough or enough times, you see things that the visual effects team does with it. You know, when Casper's flying around the ship mm-hmm. and kind of running into the faces of security guards. I mean, just for a frame.
Yeah.
When it's knocking them over, there's a flash of illumination on these guys. You know, it must have taken really painstaking animation yeah. to make this stuff yeah. done, but without it, it wouldn't have looked nearly as real.
Yeah.
You know, and there's other little touches, like when the force fields are mm-hmm. activated, the normally constant strobing red alert light is kind of a side scrolling mm-hmm. one.
Yeah, it's very
it's
cool.
odd. I mean, you look at it looks like a progress bar just because there's a force field there, and this is something no one would ever notice right. unless of course you watch the episode 12 times over
right.
5 years and. You know, that kind of attention to detail on the production side is really, really admirable and very rare.
Yeah.
I mean, back then and today.
Yeah.
So
I think you can definitely see not just Moore's influence, but Pillar's influence for sure. They have a new cinematographer in the third season.
Yes.
And I mean, this is a director they've had, Winrich Kolbe, I believe. He's been a director on the show since season one, I think. I think that's who directed this one.
And he continues to be. He directed the Voyager pilot, even. He stays right. with the series, with the right. franchise for a long time.
But I think even though it's that same director, he's moving the show forward. And, yeah. you know, I love even the set, the house set is fantastic. You know, getting them off the ship, even though they're still on the ship, creating this right. world that, you know, it's a fantasy world that they just accept, you know. At no point are you figuring out, like, well, when are they just going to run into the real wall? Because, you know, there's not space for this. You accept right. it. And it's actually really cool. I like that idea that you walk into the room and it's huge.
It's huge and it's immersive, yeah. too. And the contrast when the house, he's in the house and it's warm and there's yeah. bird song in the background and there's a cat he's playing yeah. with. And then, you know, the Enterprise adjusts the shield modulation and it all goes away. Yeah. And the contrast between that house and that stark, cold Enterprise-D space yeah. Marriott is just so heartbreaking in that moment. And when you see Jeremy just fall out of it.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, it's excellently done yeah. in that way. I agree.
So powerful. So, yeah, I think we're really seeing the show growing the beard, as we've said before, with more than just action and adventure, but also digging into the more cerebral aspects of things, and also showing its chops at doing those intricate details, as you say, and making a show that's exciting to watch, you know, over and over again to see the little details that they put so much effort into.
It's grown the beard already, and now it has also popped the collar.
Right. Pop the collar.
There you go.
No. Right. Too lame? Yeah, too lame.
No, I think that's right. perfect.
Well, thanks for joining us, Michael, to talk about this today, following your
Thank
Guinan
you guys
audition.
For
me. It's great to have you with us again.
Pleasure to be here, guys. Thank you.
Now, Chris, I sense that you were satisfied with that episode.
Very
I'm not
good.
Sure, though.
Well, it's very good. That's why we have the video cameras running here as we record, so that you can make the most of your empathic powers.
Right. But no, I do hope our listeners go back and watch The Bonding if they haven't seen it recently. It's a little rough around the edges still. You can see Pillar's involvement and Roddenberry's meddling. Makes it a little bit weaker, I think, than Moore's original script is going to be. And then, yeah, sure, go back and watch In the Pale Moonlight to see sort of the concept a little bit more on the nose as far as using the holodeck to deal with grief. Maybe we should put that on our list of shows to do soon.
Oh, definitely. Well, and that also illustrates how far the franchise went during that period of time as well in terms of talking about these things. But yeah, it was a good discussion. You proposed this episode, and I honestly wasn't quite sure what I was going to say about it at first.
Right.
Not that I dislike it. It's just kind of one of those episodes that, and the reason why a lot of listeners probably haven't seen it recently, it's one of those episodes that you watch as you pass through season three. You typically don't go and put it back in over and over. You know, it's not the best of both
right.
worlds that you want to kind of watch time
right.
and time again. So. But
I don't think it's a show that sticks with you unless you sit down and just watch it. If you know, if you're watching it as a marathon, if it's, you know, if it's show 3 or 4 on the DVD, maybe you just move past it and don't really think about it. Just think, oh, well, that was that episode with, you know, Wesley and Worf. Yeah. And you don't really give it much thought. But I think when you break it down, you think about its component parts, you think about how it deals with Troy, how it is more cerebral Star Trek. I think it is one that should stick with you and should be thought of as part of what makes Next Gen, Next Gen.
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely that. All right. Well, why don't we tell people how to contact us in case they want to share their thoughts on the bonding. And you can go to trek.fm/contact and send us a text message through there. If you want to leave us a voicemail, you can call 646-652-TREK. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at username TrekFM, where we're always talking about Star Trek. And Greg, people can find you on Twitter as well.
Yep, I'm on there as Greg Harbin. And you'll see me with most of my tweets ending #BSG2012. Part of the reason I wanted to do this episode today is because I'm on a Ronald D. Moore marathon. So follow me along. I'm about midway through season 2 right now. I'm watching Home Part 2 with the Ronald Moore podcast commentary. You know, Ronald Moore is part of why I'm into podcasting today. So not just the reason I'm into Star Trek, but the reason I'm so much into sci-fi and even podcasting is because of Ronald Moore. So
that's right.
Ron, if you're listening, please direct message us at Trek FM and come on the show.
And it's going to be great, too. Around the middle of this year on the Ready Room is when Greg is going to start breaking out the whiskey as we record the show.
Yes. As listeners, I mean, if you've heard the podcast commentaries, I guess they're on the DVDs, too. But Moore gets more and more comfortable as he does the podcast. And eventually he's got his cigarettes, he's got his whiskey, he's got his wife.
Yeah.
And it's just this one big Mrs. Ron.
They're very casual.
It's phenomenal.
Those things are interesting because they are on the DVDs, but they were originally done as podcasts. And I'm not sure that they were planning to put them on the DVDs originally because they are very casually done. They're not the, you know, polished, like in a recording studio type things that you get, say, on a Star Trek motion picture commentary track. So,
well, and they're candid, you know, just
well,
like
that's what I like about them. Yeah.
The Moore and Braga commentary on Generations, which was, you know, what, 8 to 10 years after the film came out. Okay, sure. They're very candid about their problems with the film, about a few of the things that happened in development that they're unhappy with. But the fact that Moore was releasing these commentaries the day the show was released and on a show, you know, got a little iffy in the second season, and he would blast it. You know, he said, you know, this is my fault, but this episode is not good. And it was astonishing to watch a show and think, that was okay. And then go listen to the commentary and the creator is saying, we really messed up this week and we're sorry. We hope next week is a better show. It's just really astonishing to hear that sort of honesty from a creator.
Yeah. Yeah, that is what makes those interesting. Those in particular, the casual candid nature of them. Yeah, well, we also should mention that if you want to follow Michael on Twitter, you can follow him at Fats Rikerbeard is his username. And Michael has promised that one of these days on the Ready Room, he is going to tell us the backstory of that username of Fats Rikerbeard. It may have something to do with an audition. It may not. It may have something to do with the t-shirt business that we apparently are starting for Star Trek shirts here. We're not sure, but we'll find out. And you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. You can find Trek FM on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. And also, Greg, I don't know if you've seen them yet, but we just released over the weekend a set of new Facebook timeline covers for Trek FM, so
they're
you can get
cool.
For TOS, TNG, they're like our colors uniform wallpapers that we do, and we'll be doing more as time goes on, so just go to the site, look under downloads, and you'll find them there. You can find us on Google Plus at hyperchannel/TrekFMG+, and that's where we are, so just drop us a line, let us know if you follow us somewhere, say hello, we'd love to talk to you and talk about Star Trek. So, Greg, I'm going to go out and see if I can find some aliens that can build a whole world to make me happy.
Yeah, Chris, I think it's time to stick some Brill Cream in it, because the Ready Room is done.
Thank you.